This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On ABC Listen.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Good morning. So the breaking news this morning is that the young adults in your life, aged 18 to 20, who are working in the retail, fast food or pharmacy sectors, will be paid as adults, as 21 years or older. The Fair Work Commission has issued its decision to abolish junior pay. That's the 18 to 20 year old pay rate. The under 16s are still the same. It's a landmark ruling. Tell me what you think. I'm Mary Guerin. This is The Conversation Hour and we want to be talking to you. It will take time to be phased in. Is this just the right thing at just the right moment for the young people in your lives? They're already disproportionately hit by the fuel crisis that's going on. Their future is uncertain. Is it just the right time for them? Or maybe you're an employer. Is this the absolute last thing that you need? Is this a blow that employers can't take right at this point in time? We'll get reactions from the unions. It's a win for them, of course, and also someone from the Australian Industry Group to get their opinion. But I'd love to hear from you. Already before that was announced this morning, I wanted to ask the question, how much should employers be expected to help their employees during this crisis? Should, for instance, they be giving fuel allowances to their employees if they can't work from home, if they don't have access to public transport? They're living away from the cities. They just don't have a choice. I thought of it because we heard this week of a New South Wales regional tourism operator who said he was giving his employees, if they have to travel more than 10 kilometres to work, a fuel allowance. So I wanted to ask, is that something that you've seen in your life or that you would consider doing or that you think should happen? Should the federal government in this stage of the plan that we're finding ourselves in, should they be encouraged to do that? Raph Epstein asked the Prime Minister about that this morning. His answer was non-committal. We'll play that for you. I'd love to know what you think though. Can employers afford to lean in for their employees or do they absolutely need to? Do they have the duty to do that? Let me know what you think. Also, the headline announcement yesterday from National Cabinet is that from tomorrow, the fuel excise will be cut, and that means the federal government will get about 26 cents per litre less. So for many of us, tomorrow became a red letter day. We changed our habits. We thought, okay, we're going to wait till Wednesday and go in then, because maybe you're expecting a price drop. But the industry says, hold your horses. You probably won't see that tomorrow. It'll take time for petrol stations to sell the more expensive fuel, that is anything essentially before midnight tonight. By the time the retailers sell the new fuel at the lower prices, the underlying price of the petrol may have risen and essentially gobble up that cut. So the fact is it's still better than it would have been. It's still 20 cents less a litre than you would have paid. But how does that make you feel to know that this fuel excise cut isn't necessarily going to be resulting in lesser prices tomorrow? Are you still grateful or are you disappointed? We've heard from listeners that you're expecting a big rush for fuel tomorrow. Maybe some of you are going to stay away because of that. Because as we know, if disappointed crowds are turning up, who cops that? Retail staff have been copping that. We've heard that story and we're going to hear a plea from the industry to please manage your expectations about the Bowser prices. And even if you can't manage your expectations, please manage your tempers. How will you be feeling if the fuel excise cut doesn't result in an actual decrease in fuel prices? Later, we will be getting to farmers and their mental health. We meant to get to that yesterday and we just didn't, but we want to follow up because it's important. If you're a farmer, how are you caring for yourself and for your family? Stick around for that one and join the conversations. Also later in this hour, young dads are apparently, according to a new study, embracing more traditional parenting roles. It's a new study. The results might surprise you. It certainly surprised me. I'd love to have you be part of the conversation.
on 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
So just to recap, the Fair Work Commission issued its decision this morning. It will abolish junior pay rates for young adult employees. That means 18 to 20 are no longer subject to discounted junior rates. Nothing will change for those under 16. And this is a landmark decision. There is a phase-in period, but it is a win for the unions. Josh Cullinan is the Director of Strategic Litigation at the Retail and Fast Food Workers Union and joins me now. Hi, Josh. How do you feel about this decision?
Oh, look, we're happy but concerned. So there's actually quite a bit of complexity to what has been found today. The adult rates for 18 and 19-year-olds will apply where they've worked with the same employer for 6 months. Outside of that, the junior rates for those under 18 stay the same, and the junior rates for 18, 19 and 20-year-olds stay the same if they don't have 6 months service. So it's a bit complicated, and our primary concern right through the case was that junior rates needed to be abolished to guarantee job security for all these workers.
I guess I'll just pick up on the last part of what you just said. You wanted the junior rates to be to produce security. With the pressure on employers at the moment, might it not do the opposite?
Well, that's one of the concerns, is that we know some of the very, very large fast food companies and retailers churn their young casual workers as they get older to save money. Mm. And we're very concerned that we're going to see that multiplied and magnified because of the rate differences. For someone who is 18 and has 6 months and 1 day service, they'll have to pay them double what they're paying a 16-year-old. And we're concerned that this is just going to lead to more and more churn when the solution was to abolish all junior rates.
So are you suggesting that an employer, a more, well, cynical, or at least let's just call it cost-cutting employer, will put an 18-year-old on for instance, six months minus 1 day?
We know that will happen. And unfortunately, we've run the cases, we've done some great work with the ABC in years gone by, that have exposed that some of these really large companies have 85% casual workforces, because as you get older, and I think anyone who works at many of the major fast food companies will know that your birthday means fewer shifts. And so we know that this is the tactics that are used when the benefit is so great. And for these, 18-year-olds that are turning, that are getting up to their 6 month mark, it will literally increase their rate from 70% to 100%. Now, that's a good thing, that they're going to get paid 100%. But unfortunately, if they're casual, it will also lead to them on their six-month mark being offered fewer shifts, because that employer, and some of them are multinational behemoths, can save a dollar. And we know that that's what they'll do.
You're listening to Josh Cullinan, who is from the Retail and Fast Food Workers Union. We're talking about the cut in junior rates, with caveats, from the Fair Work Commission this morning. So, Josh Cullinan, with the problems that you still have with this landmark ruling, there were months of hearings that led up to this. What's the next step for you?
Well, I think we've got to participate in a process with the Fair Work Commission to bed down what these next 4 years will look like with these phasing in. But the reality is we'll be working with our members in workplaces to negotiate the abolition of junior rates. That's what we've already been doing for the last 10 years. That's what we'll continue to do, because we think that that will drive much greater job security, but it will also drive a living wage for workers. There's no difference between, our members that are 16, 17, living out of home because of situations at home, they can't be there, but they're being subjected to 50 or 60% junior rates, even though they've got all the same cost of living. The fuel price is the same for them. The rent is the same for them. There's no discounts in that space. And so we'll keep organising with them.
So are you talking about not only you want better conditions for those between 18 and 20 without this sort of phase in, phase out part of that, those rates, you also want to see a change for people who are under 16?
For under 18.
For under 18, 16, 17.
Absolutely. Their first experience of work should be a really positive experience, which doesn't decline as they get older. It should be a full rate, and it should mean less hours having to be worked while they're at school. They're all part of our submissions over the last couple of years, and in fact, every year at the annual wage review. But we think that that is what a modern democracy should be doing, and many do. Go across the ditch to New Zealand, no junior rates there. And we think that that is a really positive step that we should all be pursuing.
Josh, this question in on text I'll put to you without notice, and apologies if you can't reach for this, but can you provide some sample hourly rates to help us understand the impact? James is asking.
Yeah, sure. So, for example, at the moment, the minimum rate for an adult in retail or fast food is $26.55. So $26.55, non-casual adult rate. At the moment, a 16-year-old who's working, you know, at the checkout or working at a fast food counter will be getting paid $13.28 per hour. And in fact, someone younger, so you can have in parts of Australia, not in Victoria, but in other parts of Australia, well, with licence as you can in Victoria, 13 and 14-year-olds and 15-year-olds working, they can be working for as little as 40% of that rate. So down at the $11 per hour mark for each hour of work.
To play devil's advocate, does the change to the 18, 19, 20-year-old rate mean that more 16 and 17-year-olds will get work?
Well, that's certainly what the employers were saying in the hearings, and I think in reality that's what we're going to see. We, unfortunately, whatever we describe it as, we think there'll be a very fast and very significant move to drive over the next couple of years more and more 13, 14, 15, 16-year-olds into the workplace because the payoff is so significant. And that's what the employers were saying they would do. That's what we've been saying they've been doing all along. And so we will see some of the big players, some of the largest corporations, have very active advertising schemes. At the moment, you see a couple of fast food companies that do that, but I think we'll see more and more companies now stepping forward to push for that very young worker being brought into their workplace.
So, Josh Cullinan, it sounds like you still are going to take it up to the Fair Work Commission to look through that detail. But another question we were asking in the light of the fuel crisis that we've got at the moment, particularly when it comes to young workers, do you believe that there should be more encouragement or expectation on employers who are also struggling to help out their employees who need to travel for their work, who can't work from home, who do not have access to public transport?
Well, absolutely. I live outside a regional town in central Victoria, and there is no real public transport where we are. We have to drive our teenagers to work. For the young workers, 18, 19 and 20, that have to be driving themselves to and from work, the cost is real. You know, it's getting to a point where it's almost doubled for those that are driving diesel vehicles. And so there does need to be very, very quick intervention. These are workers paid junior rates and will be for years. And so there needs to be some kind of intervention. These employers should certainly be helping them. And if they're not able to, there should be governmental intervention, particularly for workers and communities where they don't have access to the free public transport, as we're about to experience in Victoria, or to be able to work from home. And that's retail, fast food, hospitality. All of these workers are going to be spending the money on their petrol, diesel and gas to get to and from work, and there needs to be help.
Josh Cullinan, thank you for making time as that news has been breaking today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Josh Cullinan, Director of Strategic Litigation at the Retail and Fast Food Workers Union. Let's quickly go now, though, to Lee Howard, an industrial lawyer, to get his perspective. Hello, Lee. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What we heard there from Josh Cullinan is that essentially he wants to see more details. He wants to see there are still some details to be thrashed out. What is the process here? When can the young people who might be listening expect real movement on these wages?
So what's happened today is the full bench of the Fair Work Commission's issued a preliminary decision. And as Josh was explaining, there's a bedding down process after that. But what's foreshadowed is that these new wages will take effect from 1 December 2026, and there will be a graduated change to wages for those aged between 18 and 20 from up until 2029. So it's going to be a staggered progressive change to those rates up until 2029.
So my 18 and 19-year-old kids can't expect to change overnight?
No. So, for example, it's foreshadowed in this preliminary decision that the wages for an 18-year-old in retail, fast food and pharmacy would change from 70 to 75% of the adult wage rate, and then go 5% upwards right up until 2029. Yep. So it's going to be a staggered change over a number of years. And that the purpose of that is to allow the employers to properly adapt.
Is it possible for the unions to have any more gains past this point? Is that your understanding of the process, that it's there could still be movement on the things that Josh Cullinan was talking about in terms of any of those staggered timetables?
There could be, but I think it would be unlikely. The unions and the employers ran their cases. They've sort of decided what's going to happen. So, for example, the decision that these new wage rates will only affect those aged 18, 19 and 20 rather than 16 and 17, that's set in stone. Mm. It's more just the bedding down of the actual decision. And it's, I think it would be unlikely that, I mean, unlikely is my word, but it's unlikely that that staggered process will change.
Yeah.
Might change at the perimeter, but yeah, it's going to be a progressive introduction of high wages over a period of time.
You're listening to Lee Howard, who is an industrial barrister. We're talking about the new wages for some young adults in a few industries. Also, Lee, I wanted to get you on to talk about potentially whether employers should be leaning in to help their employees who are struggling in this fuel crisis. We heard from one regional New South Wales tourism operator who was giving a fuel allowance and wondered whether there should be more input from employers to help their employees. And this morning, Raf Epstein on Mornings asked the Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, this question.
Do you think bosses could or should help out in that way?
Oh, look, I think that one of the things we'll see is that in tough times, we always see Australians showing the best of their character. And we'll see that yet again. You know, you'll see, I know that there's been an increase, for example, in working from home. There's been an increase in people using public transport. Of course, Victoria has a particular decision that they've made by Premier Allen to assist with that. But people will, on a voluntary basis, be helping each other out at what are difficult times.
So that's the Prime Minister, I think, in an answer that could only be described as non-committal. Lee Howard, how does it sit at the moment? What's the responsibilities? Where does it lie for an employee, no matter where they are or how long they have to get to work, to take it upon themselves for they have those costs of the commute?
Yeah, so mateship is one thing, and no doubt the Prime Minister is correct that people will be helping each other out. But the legal position at law is that in the main, and this is a significant majority of employees, are responsible to get themselves to work. That's not an obligation the employer assumes. So what I mean by that is it's not the obligation of the employer to make sure you get to work or how you get to work, and the responsibility falls on the employee. And so practically speaking, if you take public transport, that's a matter for you. If you take your diesel truck, that's a matter for you as well. There are exceptions to all of that, of course, but it's usually the employee that's picking up the tab for their responsibility to get to work.
Even in a time of crisis, what would you say to any, particularly, I guess, younger or more vulnerable employee in terms of what they can do to talk to their employer? Is that a good idea, or what other paths should they look at?
Oh, absolutely a good idea. If you're feeling the pinch because you can't afford petrol, that's something to negotiate and talk to your boss about, and accommodations may or may not be made, but it's something you always, you know, are able to talk to your boss about. But in terms of how this indirectly is fixed, we have a national wage case each year that hands down wage rises for award-reliant workers, and that'll take into account the increased cost of living. And that's not much sympathy. I accept that. But these sort of changes in the cost of living are accounted for in our general system of industrial regulation in that way. The other thing that's open for people to do is they can make applications to the Fair Work Commission to vary the awards to include some, an increased payment. So often a lot of these awards, particularly in trades, will have, vehicle allowances. And so often if you're carrying your tools in your truck, you might be paid an allowance for that under the award or your enterprise agreement. These things can be varied on application. That's probably not a realistic possibility in the sense that this fuel crisis is happening right now.
Yeah.
And those cases do take time. But the Prime Minister's not wrong. You know, a lot of this might just be people looking after each other.
Yeah, not mandated. Lee Howard, thank you for leaning in this morning and explaining some of that industrial law.
Thank you.
That's Lee Howard, industrial barrister. We will get to more about that decision around all of the rates. I'll get to more of your texts in a moment. But we need to move on because we want to talk about the fuel prices decreasing or not decreasing tomorrow morning. So many of us are thinking that they will decrease, but industry is saying, look, they may not, and please don't lash out.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
If you heard that the fuel excise was going to be cut from tomorrow and you were saving up to fill your tank, hoping for a decrease, well, my next guest is telling you that, hold your horses, Australasian Convenience and Petroleum Marketers Association CEO Rowan Lee has joined me. Hi, Rowan.
Good morning, Mary.
Why won't we see that price drop automatically tomorrow?
Well, the fuel excise isn't paid at the bowser. It's paid at the wholesale level. That is when it leaves the terminal. So the petrol underground at your servo tomorrow would have had the 52.6 cent a litre excise on it. So it's not until that stock is replaced will the lower excise price be applied. So when the replacement fuel leaves the terminal, it'll have the lower excise price applied. Now, look, there might be a few sites where you will see it almost straight away. However, for the vast majority of sites, it could be a handful of days before you see that.
And there'll be a difference between the cities and the country?
Yeah, and in some remote locations, it could be a week or more. I mean, I know of one country town where essentially they have a truckload of fuel arrive every fortnight. So, you know, in small settlements like that, it could be a bit longer. But that's the way it works. It works at the wholesale level, not at the retail level. And so it takes a bit of time for that stock to be replaced. As I said, it should be a handful of days.
The Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, yesterday said that he has written to the consumer watchdog asking it to ensure that fuel retailers do pass on the cut. Do you think that that has raised expectations of what's going to happen tomorrow?
Yes, that may, because it's a matter of managing expectations. For example, last week alone, the wholesale diesel price just last week rose by 30 cents. So we're talking about a 26.3 cent reduction in excise, but the wholesale price rose last week by 30 cents. So if that trend continues, then the excise could be gobbled up within a week or 10 days, which is unfortunate. The good news is that the terminal gate price or wholesale price for unleaded fuel from last Thursday to today has gone down 17 cents per litre. So that's good news for consumers.
So this on text without notice, Rowan, from Rosie. I find it interesting that the petrol price went up immediately the war started, but now it's going to take a few days, I guess she's saying, to go down. There will be some cynicism from, increasingly desperate motorists. What would you have to say to Rosie?
Yeah, and I get that, and I understand why people get frustrated and concerned. It is it's a very difficult market to explain to people. But what we essentially had at the start was people looking at the wholesale prices in Singapore, where we get most of our fuel. 55% of our fuel comes through Singapore. But it's fed in from Indonesia and South Korea and a whole range of other nations, about 20 different nations. But what they were looking at was the price going from $89 a barrel to $124 a barrel almost overnight. So they were then thinking, okay, so I'm going to need cash in my bank to be able to afford those elevated prices. So that's why it spiked quite quickly, because you're looking at a thing called replacement cost.
Yeah.
Okay, you've got the fuel on the ground now, but what's it going to cost me to get it, fill up my tank, set my servo tomorrow? So that's the way they looked at it, yeah.
You're listening
and
to...
And we welcome the ACCC having oversight of the industry, and the ACCC for 15 years has had complete visibility of all wholesale and retail prices.
Yeah. You're listening to Rowan Lee from the Australasian Convenience and Petroleum Marketers Association. Rowan, as you say, it's complex for you to even explain and for people to understand. Tomorrow's been set as a sort of a day when things are going to kick in. What do you fear is going to happen tomorrow?
I just hope that people understand that things won't change immediately, and that the person serving them at the service station hasn't set the tax rate, hasn't set the fuel price, and they don't control what's happening there. So I'm just a little bit concerned that people might take out their anger and frustration on retail frontline staff, which would be really unfair. They're not in control. They don't set the fuel price. So, you know, I think people should just be aware of that. And with Easter coming up, there's plenty of supply around. As of 6:30 this morning, 94% of servos in Victoria have all grades of fuel available. But if people are concerned at all, just plan ahead, have a look at any of the apps, whether it be the RACV app or Petrol Spy or Motormouth, and they'll show you where you can get your fuel if you're travelling over Easter.
How much grief have staff copped, Rowan?
Yeah, there's been a fair bit of increase of that, Mary, and also fuel theft or fuel drive-off in some areas have gone up by about 30%. So that's been really concerning. We do have a lot of the servos do have number plate recognition technology, but you know, some people try and get around that. But you know, there has been an increase in report of aggressive behaviour in the retail settings.
Oh, hopefully people can curb their expectations and their anger as well. Rowan, thank you for your time today.
Great. Thanks very much, Mary.
That's Rowan Lee from the Australasian Convenience and Petroleum Marketers Association. Gil, you've called in from Elsternwick. What did you want to say?
Hi, Mary. Look, sorry if I have missed something. I'm not being sarcastic, but I just don't understand why it isn't an immediate change if we're getting money back, yet it's an immediate change if the cost is going up. It can't work both ways, surely.
Yes, I hear what you're saying. And Rowan was, if I can, I hope I am not going to get this wrong. I guess what he is saying is they need to factor that in when it's coming in. But on the way out, they have this more expensive petrol that they've already paid for that they need to sell at that more expensive price before they get the new cheaper petrol. I guess, Gil, you're not really happy with that answer.
Not really. But thanks for trying.
Yeah, sorry. Are you going to be lining up tomorrow, Gil?
No, I won't. I'm using the car as we speak, but I've got a meeting I can't get to otherwise. But otherwise, I've not really been using it much. So
leaving it at home.
It is what it is.
Yep.
Yes.
Gil, thank you for calling in. I think, yep, you're all in the same boat. Rebecca, you're near Ballarat. What do you think about the fuel situation?
Yeah, hi, Mary. I would like to put the perspective in for someone who's an essential worker, such as teachers, paramedics, nurses. Often these people are now being priced out of the towns in which they work by websites such as Airbnb, because the prices in these regional towns are skyrocketing and people can't afford to live there. And of course, they're now travel costs are exponentially just escalating, and I feel like it should be worth considering that, you know, essential workers like this should be offered subsidies to travel because they have no option for working at home.
By their employers, you'd like to see that happen?
Employees, I think government could be chipping in for this too, because we are essential workers. I just know from experience in COVID that what happened to schools when teachers were not able to go to work.
Yeah.
I think things like that need to be considered, especially when you've got to travel at least half an hour every way to get to work.
Rebecca, that's so true. Such a good reminder of the haves and have-nots that were exposed by COVID. Thank you for calling in. We will now circle back to that conversation we were having about employers. They've got a higher cost now when it comes to 18 to 20-year-olds because of a Fair Work Commission announcement today, also this idea of them potentially leaning in to help their employees. Tim Piper, the Victorian head of the Australian Industry Group, joins me now. Hello, Tim. Thank you.
Good morning, Mary.
First off, let's go to the Fair Work Commission ruling. What do you make of it?
Well, obviously, it's a circumstance that employers weren't looking for, but now that there will be a change, it'll be introduced in 2029, I guess employers are going to have to deal with that. But what it will do, what it could mean, is that there are fewer young people going to be employed, because these people still need to be trained, they still need to be supported. So we've learned over the years that training people and supporting them costs something for employers, so that's why they've been given a lower rate. The fact that we're going to be required to pay a higher rate is going to be an impost on employers and eventually on consumers. We're all going to pay a bit more as a result of it.
We heard earlier, Tim, from Josh Cullinan, who's from the Retail and Fast Food Workers Union. He's not entirely happy either because of the conditions in this ruling. He suspects that what will happen is that if an 18-year-old's on a casual wage, that the employer will just drop them off, give them fewer shifts every 6 months so that then they don't have to pay that higher wage. Do you think that that is a danger?
I think that if there's any of that, it'll happen in a very short term. The fact is that it'll have to be introduced. You need to have employers will have to introduce the extra wages. They need to have the employees. They need to have them working with them, and they'll simply have to pass it on. So if it's in a fast food area, for example, we're going to be paying more for our burgers. We're going to be paying more for the chicken that we get. I mean, that is the fact of it, that we will have to pay for having increased wages. And unfortunately, over the years, this has usually meant that we've been able to bring young people through, train them well, give them the experience, and then they often go away with a great experience and then go into other types of work. Whether that continues to happen in the same way, we really don't know at this stage.
Does it mean that 15 and 16-year-olds will get more shifts?
I suspect not. 15 and 16-year-olds don't all work. We all encourage our kids to go to work, but whether they want to do that or not, Mary, is another matter. Of course, we'll be wanting them to work, and of course, we'll be giving them the opportunity, but I don't think it'll change anything in the way that employers treat them or the number of young people that are working.
Just to bring you back to a question that we heard there from an essential worker highlighting that, you know, there are some people who just cannot afford to drive and yet they're required to by work. People who are in the regions who might not have access to public transport and so forth. We know of one regional tourism operator in New South Wales who's offering fuel allowances. The Prime Minister is suggesting that we all need to help one another. Should more employers help their employees if they are in those positions?
Mary, I heard Rebecca make those comments and I certainly empathise with her because she is going to be one of those who is unable to stay at home. There's no flexibility for people like that and it's more expensive. But look, employers generally are normal people as well, and I'd encourage her to be talking to their employer, seeing what can be done, at least in the short term. Hopefully this is going to be a short-term blip and these prices won't be maintained. But in that short term, those people are hurting. I know that employers are actually already assisting many of their employees. They're giving them extra money to get to work. Some of them are carpooling. Some of them are actually taking buses out and picking up their workers at the same time. So they are taking measures to assist their employees. And so I recommend that she actually talks to her employer and talk about it for a short period of time, maybe a month at a time, so that she can get over this hump rather than expecting this to continue on beyond what we hope is a short period.
That's advice for Rebecca and so many others, I'm sure, in the audience. Tim, thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thanks, Mary.
Tim Piper is Victorian head of the Australian Industry Group. It's coming up to 20 minutes to 12. We do need to move on, but some of your texts here. My kids used to get heaps of shifts in fast food on public holidays when they were 15. Now older, those shifts are a thing of the past. Tony from Woodside says it's great news for pay rises. Kids like companies, example, McDonald's have made a comfortable profit from them for years. And as an ex-hospo worker of 30-plus years, a 16, 17-year-old, usually less productive than an adult. And this, an 18-year-old is legally mandated to vote and decide the fate of the country, yet we allow employers to treat them and pay them as juniors. We will get to more of your questions. Sanjay, though, you have called in as well. What do you want to say?
Yeah, it was just in response to when you were talking about employers taking on the extra costs for their employees to get to work with the higher, because of the higher fuel costs. I just don't think that that would be quite feasible for most small businesses who are already finding it tough with the increased cost of insurance, just general running costs in particular, and the inability to put up the prices to the consumer.
So you think this is not a good call from the Fair Work Commission?
No, definitely not a good call. I would not be able to survive. I would not be able to keep my business open.
Sanjay, what sort of business do you have?
I run a yoga studio.
So this will affect the people you employ? Or you're thinking about the people you employ?
They'll have to drive to work in order to teach classes, so they will be paying the higher fuel to get to work, for sure.
Yeah. Sanjay, thank you. This is a tough time for everyone and juggling all of those competing needs. Better person than I surely should solve that somehow. Thank you for leaning in, and we will get to more of your texts if we have time. But we'll move on at 18 minutes to 12 because I want to tell you about a particularly surprising study, it surprised me anyway, about the surprisingly conservative attitudes about fathering among young dads.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
So there's a new study about attitudes to fathering that surprised me. Younger dads, that is of Gen Z, from 18 years old to 28 years old, according to this study, are more likely to cling to outdated ideas that frame men as the money earners and women as the caregivers. It's a study from the Fathering Project and also Western Sydney University. It was based on a global survey of 8,000 parents, 533 are from Australia. Dr. Alina Ewald is lecturer in psychological sciences at Western Sydney University and was the lead project researcher for the Fathering Project in Australia. Thank you so much for joining me, Alina.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So, what do we make of this? 72% apparently of Gen Z fathers, as I say, from 18 years old to 28, think a father's sole responsibility is to provide financially for his children. What's going on?
Yeah, so it's a concerning trend, and the trend is actually being shown globally as well. So it's not just an Australian trend, which is quite disturbing. And it's something that we've been seeing in other research over the last couple of years. And I think although we've seen great strides in gender equality over the last 30 to 40 years, say, we have seen this backsliding in the last few years, particularly with younger men. And it's quite possible that this is because a number of pressures that are sort of all coming together, the financial crisis, a lot of changes in workplaces, things with, you know, post-COVID, also with AI, and a lot of conflicting messages for young men about masculinity and masculine identity.
Yes, certainly you have pointed to in your answer there those structural issues. I just want to pick up on that last one that you mentioned. There's the structural issues that we can all go to in terms of employability around and childcare, around equality of pay, etc. But how much a part do you think is played by some of the concerning voices that young men and boys increasingly over the past 10 years have been exposed to through social media and other places on the web?
Yeah, I think that plays quite a significant role. I think that men are hearing a lot of contradictory ideas about what it means to be a man. And I think what we've seen historically is that often in times of uncertainty, there is a push towards traditional gender norms. And I think if we sort of contextualise that against the sort of increase and rise in social media and messaging around gender equality and some confusing messages that men might have been receiving, I do think it's a significant influence on this finding, yeah.
So I'm asking you also if you're, the younger people in your life are returning to traditional male-female parenting roles. If so, why? Alina, what's the answer then? I suppose that wasn't part of your study, but what do you believe is the answer?
Yeah, I think that a number of structural things need to change, as well as societal attitudes towards men's caregiving. I think is a really good starting point. Workplaces can normalise men's caregiving. Often when men hear about flexible working or other supports for caregiving, they often think of mothers and that those supports are designed for women. So it's really important for workplaces to explicitly state that those sorts of things are also available for men, and that men also hold a very important role in terms of rearing their children.
I guess that goes towards the supports for it. How do you address the other part of it, which is the more cultural, psychological aspect of it?
Yeah, I think that's a really difficult one to tackle, and it's something that has been quite prevalent in our society in one way or another over time. But I think it would be wonderful to really highlight positive examples that we see. And I think we definitely do see that in social media, but I think it would be great to see more sort of celebrating men who are able to be stay-at-home fathers, for example, or men who are able to effectively blend paid work with caregiving, finding ways to celebrate those men and support them.
Alina, you mentioned that historically in times of financial pressure, these traditional roles are often returned to. What do we do now when we've got a war with no end in sight and all of those pressures we've been talking about in this hour?
Yeah, I agree. I think it's really come to quite a difficult point for young men in particular, and millennial fathers as well. They also are at their, you know, peak caregiving ages. So we also did find that millennial fathers were consistently traditional across, most consistently traditional actually, across their answers. So I think that that age group is also of concern. I think that providing, you know, more support. So the Fathering Project, for example, offer a range of different supports that are tailored for men. And it's something that is really lacking in the parenting space, are tailored supports for fathers. So I'd love to see more of those kind of supports that the Fathering Project offer to be sort of available for men. The other thing is men have very few places to connect with other fathers. So it would be wonderful to see, you know, communities, local councils, other groups providing spaces for men to come together as fathers and support each other. I think that would make a huge difference.
It's fascinating research, Alina. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Dr. Alina Ewald, who is from the Western Sydney University that worked with the Fathering Project that she was talking about there, that does provide support to fathers. This from Andrea on text: men 18 to 24 are still babies themselves. They should not be fathering kids. A comment rather than a question from Andrea there. Let's move on, though. It is 11 minutes to 11. Want to get to a story about our farmers. As we know, they're all under pressure. What can we do to help? And I'd love to hear from you. If you are a farmer, how are you taking care of yourself, your mental health and your family's mental health as well? Joining me now is Alison Kennedy, who's director of the National Centre for Farmer Health, who can talk about the impact and support that she has seen is supplied for farmers. Thanks for joining us, Alison.
Good morning.
What have you seen is the result of the past month of pressure for farmers?
Yeah, well, I think what we're seeing for farmers at the moment is an accumulation of stresses. So, I mean, particularly in southeast of the country, we've experienced a really significant drought event, and it's looking like it's going to be another dry season moving forward. Many farmers have always also experienced bushfire. There's kind of extra layers with global uncertainty, which is really putting stress on export markets, but also, you know, inputs. The price of fuel at the moment is putting a big strain on farmers, and also the uncertainty around being able to source fertiliser in time for seeding. So there's lots going on for farmers at the moment.
Mm. Just to give a little insight, it certainly gave an insight to me. I just want to play a person that we heard on 774 Breakfast last week. It's Nathan, a store owner in Robinvale, who was talking about the pressure on farmers. Let's have a listen.
Well, look at the situation. Have we been taken seriously? I mean, what needs to happen? Does the cities need to wake up this morning and not have food to eat for them to make decisive decisions? Is that what needs to happen? Mm. Well, this is where my emotions are coming from. I deal with a lot of people on a daily basis. I've never seen such uncertainty and stress amongst communities and farmers like I am now.
Right.
Like it's at the point where there's farmers going, they're questioning what they're even doing. Wow. Why are we doing this? Yeah. Why, I mean, how many times do you have to keep getting hit with the stick before you just walk away?
So that was Nathan Falvo talking to Rochelle and Bob there last week. Alison Kennedy, do you, I mean, you can obviously hear the emotion in Nathan's voice there. Have you also seen that there's this sense of desperation, people being taken right to the brink?
Yeah, I think some people are really struggling. I think it's also really important, though, to acknowledge that many farmers have learnt from previous challenging periods and have, you know, been quite prepared and very proactive in responding to some of these challenges. But I guess there is only so far that people can prepare for these sorts of events. You know, some of this stuff is completely out of their control.
Alison Kennedy, let's talk about that, the resources that are out there, the solutions that are there, the way people can build resilience. What would you have to say to anyone listening about what resources are out there?
I think there are actually a lot of resources out there, and yes, there are the specific, you know, those focused on resilience and mental health, but there are also a whole range of practical resources that are available out there. You know, there's the Rural Financial Counselling Service, there's decision-making workshops, there's a whole range of things that farmers can be accessing.
Are more people taking those up in recent weeks, do you know?
Oh, it is my understanding that, you know, people are taking up those services. I think some of them, there are still some stigma associated with that. You know, farmers are problem solvers and, you know, are often seeking to solve their own issues. But I think what we're also seeing at the moment is people coming together in communities and supporting each other. Seeing some really fabulous examples through the Look Over the Farm Gate program at the moment, which is small community grants designed to bring people from farming communities together with a mental health lens, but also very much that social connection.
What sort of things do they do with those grants?
Yeah, there's a huge range of things that people are doing. You know, some it is about that social connection aspect. Particularly following the bushfires, there's been a lot of thank you events for CFA volunteers. So they've been having concerts, you know, comic relief, musical evenings, family barbecues, all of those sorts of things. But then there's also capacity building. So some communities are running workshops, for example. They might be building skills around resilience and preparedness for challenging times. We're seeing, you know, communities hold events where they'll bring in a speaker to talk to mental health and resilience building, but also, you know, bringing local people together to be part of a panel to share what they're doing to look after their own mental health. So there's a huge variation of events going on within that program.
We've only got a few minutes left, but if you know of something in your community that you've seen along these lines, 1300 222 774, I'd love to hear from you. You're listening to Alison Kennedy, who is Director of the National Centre for Farmer Health. Alison, we've heard so much about the fuel crisis, of course. We've discussed that this hour. How do people get around that, are getting around that in terms of keeping up the connections?
Yeah, well, I guess communities are becoming a little bit more inventive about how they come together. And, you know, if they are able to come together locally, well, that's a great option. If they're also able to leverage off other opportunities where they're already coming together for other things. So we know, for example, you know, when the National Centre for Farmer Health is out at a field day, you know, farmers will come to a field day potentially with the idea of buying some machinery or, you know, selling some sheep, but we're able to bring them in to come and have a health check on that day. So I think we need to be thinking differently and thinking creatively about how we engage and support farmers and really leverage off those opportunities, make it best bang for buck for farmers when they are leaving home and using that fuel, which, you know, they're often more likely to try and save for some of the farm-related activities. So we've got to make it work and got to make it, you know, good bang for buck for them.
Yeah, that's right. They're always putting other priorities first. And we did get this on text asking about what you would also say for the families of farmers as well, who are themselves farmers as well. They're in the farming family. Does the National Centre for Farmer Health also reach out their supports to, you know, the people who are not necessarily doing the hard yakka, but the ones supporting the ones doing the hard yakka?
Absolutely. So, yeah, the National Centre for Farmer Health really focuses on farmers and farm workers as well as farming families, and then all of those that are working in agriculture dependent communities. So we also know that, you know, the service providers that are supporting farmers, the farming families, they are all integral to that picture of farmer wellbeing.
Alison Kennedy, thank you for joining us, and thank you for your work as well.
Pleasure. Thanks very much.
That's Alison Kennedy, Director of the National Centre for Farmer Health. That's all from me today on The Conversation Hour. Email me if you want to tell me anything we should be talking about, conversationhour@abc.net.au, or listen again on the ABC Listen app. Have a wonderful day out there. It's lovely weather, it seems. Join me again tomorrow.